Hi, this is Joe Campanelli from Heritage Radio's In the Drink. On October 21st, join me and some of the most talented chefs, bartenders, and performers in New York at Not My Day Job, a cocktail and culinary showcase. Food and cocktails from restaurants like Shake Shack, The Meatball Shop, Mark Forgione, Lartuzzi, The Wren, Colicchio & Sons, Macau Trading Company, and more will be available from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Prince George Ballroom. Tickets are only $50 and will benefit the 4th Arts Block, Greenwich House, and Urban Arts Partnership, and are available at notmydayjob2012.eventbrite.com. Hope to see you there.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, and you're listening to another episode of In the Drink, the radio show that is all about great things to drink and absolutely nothing about golf whatsoever. Zero. Zilch. Today I'm super excited. I have two of my really good friends. They are Michelin-starred chefs. They're originally from Austria, and they have some of just the greatest places around town. They have the really fine, beautiful, and elegant seasonal restaurant up in Midtown, and then the super hip, I'd say, Austrian tavern, kind of restaurant meets wine bar, meets just a really fun, cozy time in the East Village called Eddie and the Wolf. I'm here with Edward Fraunader and Wolfgang Bahn. Thanks so much, guys, for coming in. Really excited.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And then you guys are about to open up a new wine bar, I understand, or a new cocktail bar called The Third Man.
It's going to be a cocktail bar. It's half a block away from Eddie and the Wolf. It's going to be a bit more elegant than Eddie and the Wolf is. We got to offer people something different. We got very fond memories of a similar place in Vienna where we both grew up and got wasted multiple times. And we try to model it around that, the same style, which is very, very 1930s, 1920s, Art Deco, Art Nouveau. It should be inviting, it should be easy, it should be elegant, but it should not like put off people in terms of being like too highbrow for the East Village. I think we're going to have a very nice stretch there.
Right, so this is a drink show in the drink, but you guys do the wine programs, the beverage lists at your restaurant. So how will your experience as chefs inspire the cocktail program at The Third Man?
Well, I think since we are chefs and we understand our food, that was also the reason why we decided to do the wine lists, because as chefs you understand the food profile and therefore you can perfectly match the wines to that. So basically the same idea we have for The Third Man. We watched a lot of mixologists these days, bartenders, and what they are doing, and they are kind of like combining the kitchen aspect with the bar aspect. So we thought it would be a good idea to give it a try and have two chefs coming up with some cocktails.
Yeah, so do you have any cocktails that you're working on right now that you're very excited about? What are some of your inspirations?
Well, we got some like Viennese/Austrian-inspired cocktails. We've got like an apricot gin fizz with elderflower cordial. We're going to work on a kraut. We're going to use the pickling juice from Eddie and the Wolf on some bourbon cocktails at the restaurant. I've learned that actually it's like being a bartender and being a pastry chef is very close to one another in terms of garnishes and syrups, cordials, bitters, etc. So we're gonna incorporate that into the program, and having the restaurant really like half a block away with all its resources makes things much, much easier, because you can really like, you can, there's so much cross pollination and there's so much synergies between one place and the other. I think it's gonna be really, really good for both establishments.
So when they tell me that it's a half hour wait at Eddie and the Wolf, which usually it is at least, I'll head over to the Third Man, and that's kind of the idea. I mean, I know with Anfora and Del Anima over in the West Village, we definitely have Anfora kind of as our waiting room for Del Anima. You guys are so busy over there. Okay, so I recently got asked a question about wine spritzers. I was like, I don't ever drink wine spritzers. That sounds terrible. And then like, well, do you know of any wine professionals who might have any insight on them? Like, I don't think wine professionals really drink wine spritzers. And then I was like, wait a second. My friends Eddie and Wolfgang probably, you know, with their Austrian background have some insight onto it. And because the Spritz is somewhat of a traditional drink in Austria, isn't it?
I mean, a lot of winemakers. Right? Wolf is the master of the spritz. Whenever he works the vintage in Austria, the harvest, he drinks plenty of wine spritzers. And all those wine producers who come to New York, like they got shit. They get shit faced on spritzers.
It must take a lot of spritzers.
It's just a better way to do it, because you can still enjoy the wine, but you can drink much, much more, especially when it's super hot outside. Using a little bit of sparkling water or seltzer water, preferable, with some usually field blend called Gemischter Satz in Austria, perfect for the summer.
I mean, they don't spritz high-end stuff.
Right.
I mean, only on the very rare occasions. When nothing goes anymore, then you spritz the high-end stuff. But most of the time, those like very like simple understood wines who are like enjoyed with a spritz. And like, there's so many variations to the spritz. Right now in Austria, there's like the Aperol Spritz, which I think to be quite delicious. There is the that new like fairly fashionable drink in Austria called Hugo, like Wolfie's new dog. Wolfie just got a Weimaraner, so it's the same. He named the Weimaraner after a beverage. Hugo is a is basically also white wine spritz with elderflower cordial, mint, and ice cubes. So. People, there can be very delicious wine cocktails.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That sounds great, and I'm a big fan of the Aperol Spritz. I think it's just a delicious and slightly bitter way to get started.
It's super Euro.
Super Euro.
It's super Euro.
So something that I've always wondered about, and I'm glad to have you guys here to ask you this question, is you know, you guys are both co-chefs, co-creators of the restaurant. How does that work out at all? I mean, is it challenging to have two visions, or how do you guys find that you're able to work together?
It's kind of like a marriage. Like everybody brings something to the table, and then you have to make it work. I think it was a little bit more challenging back in the days.
He's talking about baggage. That's the marriage part. Everybody brings something to the table, and then we work it out.
So it was a little bit more challenging in the beginning when we stood next to each other in the kitchen, because we both had different visions of what to do, and then you have to kind of like come up with a common ground. But today we have plenty of different projects, so we kind of like split up and overlook, and then we just meet and discuss how to go forward.
I believe everything is tested multiple ways, and like, we never believed in our kitchens to be like the utmost dictatorship kitchen where like what the chef says, it's going to be done. A kitchen needs structure, but I think sometimes to test decisions in a thesis, antithesis, synthesis way, gives a better outcome, and like you also look from different perspectives on the same problem, which in my opinion is like today, and I don't believe the restaurant world to be gotten like easier the last couple of years, is a good way to just also test yourself and ask yourself, is this the right way to go about it? Is there a better way to go about it? And there's always like, you know what, there's 36 ways to cook cookover. 36 different ways, and none of the ways is right or wrong. So in that respect, there's even more than just two solutions, but at least there are two different perspectives on a problem.
Wow, that's fantastic. So I'm actually really curious about the fact that you guys both put together your wine list. Is that something that you envisioned from the start, or
Did you have a beverage director that went terribly, terribly wrong?
Well, I think it was the 2008 and the start of the financial crisis where we had to rethink the whole concept, and obviously we had to cut back. And my family background in Austria is actually the wine business. Eddie's background is bakeries and restaurants. My background is wine. So we decided, in order to save some money, that we're going to jump in. We definitely understand wine. We went to plenty of wine tastings. And so we started doing it. And after a while, we saw that it really made sense because we really matched the beverages with what we created in the kitchen. And so, I mean, at this point, we probably could afford somebody, a wine director, but decided as long as we have that time, that we're going to continue doing that. We also do the trainings in the restaurant. We teach people about Austrian German wine in particular, because this is our field of expertise. We tell them about all the differences and basically teach them how to sell the wines right. What's really important for me is not to sell the most expensive wine. For me, it's important to find the perfect wine for a dish or for the person. So have a conversation, have a long conversation with the customer, what he really wants, and then find the perfect match for him.
Yeah, I mean, I always say that the wine is the sauce for the dish that the chef never actually gets to taste. So you're actually tasting your sauce and pre-selecting it to make sure that it pairs. Because you can have a dish that you've worked on, you've put together, and then someone could absolutely destroy it with drinking the wrong wine with that dish. So I absolutely think that's fantastic. And it's something that I try to do with Gabe a lot. Because, you know, at our restaurants, Gabe has a very particular profile. Food tends to be very spicy, very high acid, and a lot of salt. And so there are only particular wines that can go with those kind of dishes. So I always try to choose the wine list to go around the food, because ultimately people are there to eat.
So you choose a lot of like Northern Italian?
A lot of Northern Italian wines, exactly. A lot of aromatic wines are really great with that. Red wines that are juicy and have lots of acid, but not very dry or oaky, I think pair well with that kind of food as well. What kind of wines? I know your lists are mostly Austrian, but then what kind of flavor profiles go well with your food? One of the things I really appreciate about the restaurants is, sure, there are some of the more traditional dishes, maybe a little bit of the heavier dishes, but I think that you guys also show the fresher, lighter side of Austrian cuisine, and I think that's just exciting, and definitely with what New Yorkers want to eat right now.
It's a bit more modern approach to like to Germanic fare. We know that these days, like, beer gardens are like super, super up and coming, all the German charcuterie, sausage culture, which people do enjoy, especially over the summer. This is the last leg of the summer. I hope it stays a bit warmer for a bit longer. But like, since we are like younger chefs as well, we wanted to focus more on a refined execution of Austrian cuisine. And Austrian cuisine ultimately is meat and potato, but nobody says that meat and potato does have to give you a heart attack after you finish the plate. So therefore, I believe that this like more elegantly executed fare also fits the people who come to our places. It's a very wide range in terms of age group. Like, honestly, at Eating the Wolf, you got everything on a Saturday, Sunday, from like 4 to 84. It's a pretty wide stretch. And it's beautiful to see a restaurant who can attract that wide array of people, because normally, and you know it from New York, it's a mostly homogenous clientele who goes to a certain restaurant, and to have something what appeals to so many different age groups, it's special.
I just hope you don't serve them Spritzer, the people who are 4 years old.
No. just for the protocol, we ID everybody, even if you come in in a wheelchair with gray hair. It's okay.
Yeah, I don't think that anyone will ever be insulted by IDing them. That's kind of my policy. If you're clearly beyond ID'd age, you're gonna feel good that you're ID'd. And I don't think anyone will ever be insulted by that. But yeah, as the weather is getting a little bit cooler, I'd love Eddie particularly in the in the cooler months. It has mm-hmm. just a real warm coziness to it. It's dark, it's cozy, it's sexy in there, and I definitely check out Eddie and the Wolf in the cooler months. But we're going to take a quick break right now. Thanks again to our guests, Eddie and the Wolf, Eddie Fraunader and Wolfgang Bahn from Eddie and the Wolf and Seasonal, and we're going to be back in just a few minutes with In the Drink.
Network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Did you know that pollinators are needed for more than two-thirds of the world's crop species? Most of these pollinators are bees. However, North America's bee population has been steadily declining since the 1990s. Whether you live in the country or the city, you can show your commitment by hosting a hive in your backyard or even on a rooftop. The beekeeping movement is growing, so you're sure to find swarms of folks who can help you find your way. Learn more about the ways you can help be the solution at wholefoodsmarket.com/sharethebuzz.
All right, welcome back to In the Drink. I'm here with Eddie Fraunader and Wolfgang Bahn from Seasonal Restaurant, Eddie and the Wolf, the great Austrian tavern in the East Village, and the soon-to-open The Third Man Cocktail Bar, the chef-inspired, recipe-driven cocktail bar, which is also going to be in the East Village. It's going to be great. It's definitely one of the most anticipated openings of the fall, along with, I'm going to plug my own, La Picho, but... La Picho and The Third Man, the two most anticipated openings of this fall season. Anyway, Eddie and Wolfgang brought a little something for us to taste. Is this inspired by Oktoberfest? Is that what's going on here? This is an enormous bottle of beer.
Exactly. It's Altmünster Fest beer or Oktoberfest beer. This particular brewery belongs to the Radeberger Group. I think the Radeberger Group is the biggest brewery group in Germany, which is part of the Dr. Oetker family. It's a family-run business, food-providing business, kind of similar to Kraft. I really like the guys behind the Radeberger Group. They have amazing products, Radeberger beer, Hövels, some wheat beer, and this in particular, they just brew every fall, basically for the Oktoberfest. So it's kind of like the harvest fest for the beer brewers. They want to celebrate their harvest, and they usually produce a little bit higher alcohol beer, which obviously has a lot of flavor as well.
Yeah, you've worked hard.
Should we pop it open?
Oh yeah, let's do this.
All right.
Can you describe this? I kept calling it the suctiony top, but I'm sure that's not the name of it. How would you describe the way this beer is enclosed?
It's number one. It's such a large format that I guess it's intended. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
And just for the protocol, I ID'd everybody who entered this room. And first and foremost, since it's such a large format, want to reclose this for the carbonation purposes. It's a ceramic pop with a like a little rubber band, and it's a really, really old closing mechanism. Goes back to the monk beers from Germany, and it's just delicious, man. And it stays so fresh, and you can open it, you can drink two, three glasses, you can close it again, it doesn't lose anything. you never lose the cap because it's attached to the bottle. It, there's so many advantages.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Let's taste this.
All right, cheers.
Prost.
Huh? Cheers. As you can see, the color is also a little bit more amber, a little darker.
I really like the format. I always say that anytime you bring a Magnum, a large format bottle of wine, that gets the party started. I can see why they call this the Festbier.
This is the German growler.
This is the
German version of a growler. So
you have the combination of the German growler and the size, and then that great champagne pop when you pop the cork. And yeah, you know the party's going to get started. This beer is delicious.
It's much, fantastic.
Much maltier than you see with a lot of American craft beers these days.
And again, it's just available for a couple of months during Oktoberfest, and then it disappears. I think what they do for the holiday season, they create Bock beer, kind of like similar, also high in alcohol for more celebration and for better booze.
So getting quicker drunk is called more celebration. just note to yourself.
Can you tell us about the Oktoberfest celebration? Does it translate over into Austria, or do Austrians just go next door to Germany and to have some fun?
I think for the real experience, you have to go to what they call the Wiesn in Munich. This is where the Oktoberfest happens. But I think there are a lot of different festivals in Austria and Germany where they use like huge tents. They have traditional music. Pretty much the same fare, roasted chicken, sausages, everything is very, very meat heavy, and then they consume massive amounts of beers.
And it's only 1 liter jugs.
Only 1 liter jugs.
Originally, it's only 1 liter. The idea of the Oktoberfest was that they actually opened this like imperial garden to the public. So it's basically, it was like the aristocracy being together with the regular people, like back in the days. It was like in 1780. So that's why it's called the Wiesn. That's when they opened this like lawn and had like everybody celebrating together. I like the egalitarian spirit behind it. It's good. No, absolutely. And in 47% days.
Yes, that's true. That's a good point. You know, one of my favorite German beer drinking traditions, though, is of the Kölsch beer. It's something that we always have on draft, and it's what I want at the end of my shift. But quite the opposite of the 1 liter. You get the Kölsch in a very, very small glass. And I remember, you know, it's a common beer from Cologne. And one of the things I love about it is that before your glass is completely finished, they come and give you a new, fresh, cold glass of Kölsch. It's kind of like refilling water here in New York. And so when I see those 1 liter jugs of beer, I'm like, how are they going to have
this cold till the end of the end of the glass? I wonder the same thing. But I'm sure there are some experts out there. They keep it extra fresh and cold. They drink it so fast.
Or you have to drink it extra fast, huh?
I couldn't do it.
And it's also quite a challenge for the women who basically serve on the Wiesn, because they have to carry those huge stone mugs full with 1 liter of beer. And they don't carry one or two. They usually run around with 8 to 10, like 4 to 5 in each hand.
There's championships.
Which is there's quite
honestly
amazing.
There's at the end of the Wiesn, to like either at the beginning or the end, they make at the beginning to promote it, and at the end to find the person who can carry the most. They actually have championships. What woman can carry? What waitress can carry the most 1 liter mugs? It's bizarre.
It's so scary.
It's bizarre.
So that's not just for tourists at the Hofbrauhaus. That's like at all Oktoberfest.
It's called German efficiency.
German efficiency.
And they have to train all year to do that. They don't need a gym in Bavaria. They just carry the stone mugs.
Well, if you ever want to have a training camp at Eddie and the Wolf, I will. I'll be happy to be a judge. I'm just putting my services out there. I'll volunteer. I'd be happy to do that. So one of the things that, you know, any international wine list or European focused wine list right now has to have Austrian wines, or they're completely world-class wines. You know, I think you're seeing a lot of sommeliers, especially getting excited about the Grüner Veltliner, the native grape to Austria, and for some reason, I find that Austrian producers, though, I speak to, get a little bit more excited about their own Rieslings. Do you find that that's the case? What Austrian whites are people drinking? And then we're going to talk about the reds as well, because I'm in love with a few Austrian reds.
Well, I think Corona Veltliner is the most produced Austrian white wine grape. So people in Austria, especially the lighter wines, they love to drink their Corona Veltliners. Riesling is the second most important white wine grape in Austria. But if you really get into the wine business, and I spoke to a lot of sommeliers and wine purchaser in New York City, and everybody loves Rieslings. Austrian Riesling, German Riesling. It's the high acidity, it's the beautiful balance, it's the minerality which usually comes out, especially when you leave a little bit of residual sugar. Mm-hmm. It's really just beautiful. But of course, we, as two Austrians, we don't want to just stick to those two. We also want to showcase the rest of the Austrian varieties. There's, for instance, Gelber Muscatella, which we both love in summer. Very floral, very light, 10.5% to 11% alcohol. You can sit outside, you kind of like feel the grass and all the flowers around you. You feel it in the bottle, and you can drink more than a bottle without being drunk. And once we move into fall and winter, where the dishes are getting a little bit heavier, we also like to choose some of the little bit more full-bodied white wines. Not necessarily higher in alcohol, mm-hmm. but just full-bodied by itself. Rote Veltliner, which has the same name as Grüne Veltliner, just red. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a red wine. It just has a red skin, but the wine is actually white. Neuburger, Gewürztraminer, those are the grapes we really like to showcase more in fall and winter.
What I also believe when it comes to the differentiation between Austria and German Riesling, what you just mentioned before, mm-hmm. I believe the Austrian Riesling to be a bit more well-balanced and elegant, a bit more mineralically driven, especially when they come from the Wachau. But of course, there's always this like little game in between winemakers who makes the better Riesling. And of course, the Austrians think that the Austrians are making the better Rieslings, and the Germans think they make the better Rieslings. But this is kind of like a playing field where I think both countries produce like wonderful wines, even though I tend to believe that the Austrian Rieslings are a tiny bit more better priced. Mm-hmm. The Austrian high-end Rieslings are better priced than the German high-end.
Yeah, I think that's an argument for the ages. That's never going to be resolved. I mean, I think you'll find just as many people, you know, even among sommeliers on either side of that. I tend to like both of them very much. But certainly a drier style, but also with a little bit of the residual sugar. I find that if it's bone dry, sometimes the wines tend to be a little bit more muted. Even though I know that's the style that more people are going for right now, the super super bone dry Rieslings. But those are certainly really age worthy wines as well. Like with all that acidity, it's just great wines. And you know, something that I think a lot of people might find a little bit surprising, because I think Austria is really is associated with those great white grapes, is how interesting and unique the reds can be. We have quite a few Austrian reds on the list at Amphora, and I really love them. What are some of your favorite? What do you think are some of the interesting Austrian reds? I think what's most interesting in Austria is, like you said before, those unique native indigenous grapes. So maybe some of the Blaufränkisch and Zweigelt and unique grapes that are interesting to Austria.
Well, for me, Blaufränkisch, coming from Burgenland, which is the very eastern part, and also the red wine country, so to say, for me, Blaufränkisch is the most important one. And I think Austria came a very long way from the 80s, where there were some scandals, and basically the wine industry was completely destroyed. But it also helped Austrian winemakers, the new generation, the kids actually left Austria. They studied abroad, they worked abroad, they went to Northern Italy, they went to Burgundy, Bordeaux. A lot of people studied in California and Australia. And then they came back after a couple of years in abroad and started applying those techniques for Austrian winemaking. And what they tried to do in the beginning, they went very international in terms of grapes. They planted a lot of Merlot, they planted a lot of Cabernet Sauvignon, Syrah, and after a couple of years they figured out, you know what, why don't we stick to our native grapes, Blaufränkisch, Zweigelt, St. Laurent. And what the outcome was is really fantastic, because all of a sudden in the last 10-15 years we see Blaufränkisch and Zweigelt with a lot of potential, super minerality, great concentration, wines which definitely can compete on the international market more so than Merlots or Cabernet Sauvignon from Austria, because there are other regions in this world who just have a much better climate for those international grapes.
Yeah, and you can find a Merlot grown in, you know, 50 countries around the world, but no one else is really growing the Zweigelt and Blaufränkisch. And one of the things I really love about Austrian reds is that I find them to be to have a lot of flavor, to be full flavor, but without being too high in alcohol, without being too overbearing. So I find that they have really great, refreshing acidity, which is the trick of the sommelier, to choose a wine that has a really great acidity. It makes you look like a brilliant sommelier, but you know, you guys know that as chefs, that dishes have to be balanced out, and I find that a wine that has crisp acidity balances out most dishes.
They're also very food friendly. Like Austrian whites and reds are both, because more or less a cooler climate, and even though Burgenland can get really, really hot in the summer, they're very food friendly. They're not too concentrated. They have a very subtle usage of wood. They're not too alcoholic, as you said before. They're not too concentrated. Mm-hmm. And there's also grape varietals. Most people don't even know. Like for instance, St. Laurent. St. Laurent is a grape varietal. Like everybody thinks it's French, even though it's Austrian. And it's the newcomer, because I think people get more familiar with like Blaufränkisch and Zweigelt, and it's cool and it's hip and this and that. And then you guide them to the direction of St. Laurent when they want to drink something a bit heavier, and they drink really, really well, and they have beautiful bodies. They are very, very, they're easy to understand, but still not simple. And I think people really go into that direction. Also, some of them come and ask for Pinot Noir, and I think growing Pinot in Austria, with especially in like Lower Austria, Pinot is a very thin-skinned grape. Mm-hmm. So in a cooler climate, it takes a lot of art of the winemaker to produce good results. So, but it's starting that people do produce beautiful Pinots in Austria, and I think people really appreciate it in New York.
Wow. I am absolutely blown away with two chefs just completely schooling all of us on Austrian wine and drinking culture. Thank you so much. We have Eddie Fraunader and Wolfgang Bahn of Eddie and the Wolf Seasonal and the soon-to-open The Third Man down in the East Village. Thanks a lot, guys, and thank you for listening to In the Drink. I'm Joe Campanelli, and see you next week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.